You should be with your family. I can't be with my family, Andy. That's the fucking point. My family is dead. Okay. I look down at the ground, at his white sneakers spattered with mud and pine needles. I'll tell you something, Rifkin added. It doesn't matter what happens to me now. I could become a drug addict or a thief or a bum. It just doesn't matter what happens to me from here. Why should it? Why should I care? He said this with a bitter snarl. Call your office, Andy. A beat. Go on, call. It's over. You're out. I took out my cell phone and called Lynn Canavan directly on her cell. It rang three times. I could imagine her reading the caller ID window, preparing herself to answer. I'm at the office, she said. Why don't you come down here right away? I told her, as Rifkin looked on with satisfaction, that if she had something to say, she could say it right then and save me the trip. No, she insisted. Come to the office, Andy. I want to talk to you face to face. I snapped the phone shut. I wanted to say something to Rifkin, goodbye or good luck or some valedictory bullshit, who knew what. Something told me he was right, and this was goodbye. But he did not want to hear it. His posture announced as much. He had already assigned me a villain's role. Probably he knew more than I did anyway. I left him on that green field and drove across the river to Cambridge in a defeated reverie. I was resigned to the fact that I would be removed from the case. It simply did not make sense that Rifkin would have come up with that on his own. Somebody had tipped him off. Probably LeJudas, whose Iago whispers in the district attorney's ear had finally won the day. Okay, then. I would be removed for a conflict of interest, a technicality. I'd been outmaneuvered, that was all. It was office politics, and I was an apolitical guy, always had been. So LeJudas would have his high-profile case, and I would move on to the next file, the next body, the next case to enter the funnel. I still believed all this, foolish or delusional or rationalizing as I was. I still did not see what was coming. There was so little evidence pointing to Jacob, a schoolgirl with a secret, some kids gossiping on Facebook, even the knife. As evidence, these were nothing. Any semi-competent defense lawyer would swipe them aside like cobwebs. At the courthouse, there were no fewer than four plainclothes troopers waiting at the front door to meet me. I recognized them all as CPAC guys, but I knew only one very well, a detective named Moynihan. They escorted me like a Praetorian guard through the courthouse lobby to the district attorney's office, then through cubicles and hallways abandoned on a Sunday morning, to Lynn Canavan's corner office. There were three people there, seated at the conference table. Canavan, LeJudas, and a press guy named Larry Siff, whose constant presence at Canavan's side for the past year or so had been a discouraging sign of the permanent campaign. I had no beef with Siff personally, but I despised his intrusion into a sacred process to which I had devoted my life. Most of the time, he did not even have to speak. His mere presence ensured that political implications would be considered. District Attorney Canavan said, "Sit down, Andy." "Did you really think you needed all this, Lynn? What did you think I was going to do, jump out the window?" "It's for your own good. You know how it goes." "How what goes? I feel like I'm under arrest." "No, we just have to be careful. People get upset. They react unpredictably. We don't want any scenes. You'd have done the same thing." "Not true." I sat down. "So what am I going to be upset about?" "Andy," she said, "we have some bad news." "On the Rifkin case? The print on the victim's sweatshirt?" "It's your son, Jacob's." She slid a stapled report toward me. I scanned the report. It was from the State Police Crime Lab. The report identified a dozen points of comparison between the latent found at the murder scene and one of the knowns on Jacob's print card, much more than the standard 8 required for a positive match. It was the right thumb. Jacob had reached out and grabbed the victim by his unzipped sweatshirt, leaving the print on that inside tag. I said, bewildered, "I'm sure there's some explanation." "I'm sure there is. They go to the same school. Jacob is in his class. They knew each other." "Yes." "It doesn't mean we know Andy." They looked at me with pity, all except the young troopers, now standing by the window, who did not know me and could still despise me as they would any other bad guy. "We're putting you on paid leave. It's partly my fault. It was a mistake to let you have the case in the first place. These guys," she gestured toward the troopers, "will go to your office with you. You can take your personal belongings, no papers, no files. You're not to touch the computer. Your work product belongs to the office." "Who's taking the case?"
"Neil is."
I smiled.
"Of course he is."
"Andy, do you object to Neil trying the case for some reason?"
"Does it matter what I think, Lynn?"
"Maybe, if you can make a case."
I shook my head.
"No, let him have it, I insist." Lejudas looked away, avoiding my eyes.
"Have you arrested him?"
More eyes darting around the room, avoiding me.
"Lynn, have you arrested my son?"
"No."
"Are you going to?"
Lejudas cut in.
"We don't have to tell you that."
Canavan put her hand out to still him.
"Yes. We don't have much choice in the circumstances."
"In the circumstances? What circumstances? You think he's going to take off for Costa Rica?"
She shrugged.
"You already have the warrant?"
"Yes."
"Lynn, you have my word he'll turn himself in. You don't need to arrest him. He doesn't belong in a jail, even for one night. He's no flight risk, you know that. He's my son. He's my son, Lynn. I don't want to see him arrested."
"Andy," the district attorney advised, waving away my pleading like smoke,
"it'd probably be best for everyone if you stayed away from the courthouse for a while. Let the dust settle, okay?
Lynn, I'm asking you as a friend, as a personal favor. Please don't arrest him."
"It's not a close call, Andy."
"Why, I don't understand. Because of a fingerprint? One fucking fingerprint? That's all there is? You must have more. Tell me there's more."
"Andy, I suggest you go get a lawyer."
"Get a lawyer? I am a lawyer. Tell me why you're doing this to my son. You're destroying my family. I have a right to know why."
"I'm just reacting to the evidence, that's all."
"The evidence points to Pats. I've told you that."
"There's more than you're aware of, Andy. Much more."
It took me a moment to absorb the implications of that. Just a moment, though. I folded my cards and determined that from then on, I would show them nothing. I stood up.
"Okay, let's get moving."
"Just like that?
Was there anything else you wanted to say to me, you, Neil?"
Canavan said, "You know, we're still concerned about you. Whatever your son may have done, he's not you. You and I go back a ways, Andy. I don't forget that."
I felt my face go hard, as if I was peering through the eye holes of a stone mask. I looked only at Canavan, my old friend whom I still loved and still, despite everything, trusted. I did not dare glance at Lejudas. There was a wild energy rushing into my right arm. In that moment, I felt that if I so much as looked at him, my hand would flash out, snatch up his throat, and crush it.
"Are we done here?"
"Yes."
"Good, I have to go. I have to find my family right away."
District Attorney Canavan's face was wary.
"You okay to drive, Andy?"
"I'm fine."
"All right. These guys will go with you to your office."
In my office, I tossed a few things into a cardboard box, papers and desk debris, pictures plucked off the wall, the little souvenirs of years of work, an axe handle, evidence from a case I had never been able to push through the grand jury. It all fit into one cardboard box, all the years, the work, the friendships, the respect I had accumulated by little spoonfuls in case after case. All gone now, no matter how Jacob's case turned out. For even if Jacob was cleared, I would never escape the stain of the accusation. A jury could only declare my son not guilty, never innocent. The stink would never leave us. I doubted I would ever walk into a courtroom again as a lawyer, but things were racing too fast to linger over the past or future. There was only now. I was not panicked, oddly. I never did lose my nerve. Jacob's homicide charge was a grenade. We would all inevitably be destroyed by it. Only the details remained to be worked out. But a strange, calm urgency came over me. Surely a search warrant team was already on its way to my home. That may even have been why the DA had brought me all the way down here, to keep me out of that house before it could be searched. It was exactly what I would have done. I bolted out of the office. I called Lori Sell from the car. No answer.
Lori, it's very, very important. Call me back right away, the second you get this message. I called Jacob's cell phone, too. No answer. I got home too late. Four Newton cruisers were already parked outside, watching, freezing the house while they waited for the warrant to arrive. I continued around the block and parked. My house is adjacent to a train stop on the suburban commuter train line. An 8-foot fence separates the platform from my backyard. I spidered over it easily. There was so much adrenaline in me, I could have clambered up Mount Rushmore. In my yard, I pushed through the arbor vitae at the edge of the lawn. The leaves flicked and needled across me as I bodied through the bushes. I ran across my backyard. My neighbor was in his backyard, gardening. He waved to me, and out of neighborly reflex, I waved back as I sprinted by. Inside, I called out quietly for Jacob, to prepare him for what was coming. No one was home. I bolted up the stairs into Jacob's room, where I yanked open drawers, the closet, tossed up the laundry piles on the floor, desperate to find anything remotely incriminating and get rid of it. Does that sound awful to you? I hear the little voice in your head. Destruction of evidence. Obstruction of justice. You are naive. You imagine the courts are reliable, that wrong results are rare, and therefore I ought to have trusted the system. If he truly believed Jacob was innocent, you are thinking, he would have simply let the police sweep in and take whatever they liked. Here is the dirty little secret. The error rate in criminal verdicts is much higher than anyone imagines. Not just false negatives, the guilty criminals who get off scot-free. Those errors we recognize and accept. They are the predictable result of stacking the deck in defendants' favor as we do. The real surprise is the frequency of false positives. The innocent men found guilty. That error rate we do not acknowledge, do not even think about, because it calls so much into question. The fact is, what we call proof is as fallible as the witnesses who produce it, human beings all. Memories fail, eyewitness identifications are notoriously unreliable, even the best-intentioned cops are subject to failures of judgment and recall. The human element in any system is always prone to error. Why should the courts be any different? They are not. Our blind trust in the system is the product of ignorance and magical thinking, and there was no way in hell I was going to trust my son's fate to it. Not because I believed he was guilty, I assure you, but precisely because he was innocent. I was doing what little I could to ensure the right result, the just result. If you do not believe me, go spend a few hours in the nearest criminal court. Then ask yourself if you really believe it is error-free. Ask yourself if you would trust your child to it. In any event, I did not find anything even remotely worrisome in Jake's room, just the usual teenage junk, dirty laundry, sneakers molded to the shape of his enormous feet, schoolbooks, video gamer mags, charging cables for his various electronics. I don't know what I expected to find, really. The trouble was that I did not know what the DA had yet, what made them so anxious to charge Jacob, and it made me crazy wondering what that missing piece could be. I was still tossing the room when my cell phone rang. It was Lori. I told her to get home right away. She was visiting a friend in Brookline, 20 minutes away, but I did not tell her anything more. She was too emotional. I did not know how she would react, and I did not have time to deal with her. Help Jacob now, fix Lori later. "Where's Jacob?" I asked. She did not know. I hung up on her. I took a last glance around the room. I was tempted to hide Jacob's laptop. God only knew what was on his hard drive. But I worried that stashing the computer would hurt him either way. If the computer went missing, that would be suspicious, given his online presence. On the other hand, if found, it might contain devastating evidence. In the end, I left it. Unwisely, maybe, but there was no time to consider. Jacob knew he had been publicly accused on Facebook. Presumably, he had been wily enough to scrub his hard drive if need be. The doorbell rang. Game over. I was still breathing heavily. At the door, none other than Paul Duffy was there to hand me the search warrant. "Sorry, Andy," he said. I stared. The troopers in their blue windbreakers, the cruisers with their flashers on, my old friend extending the trifolded warrant toward me. I simply did not know how to react, so I barely reacted at all. I stood there, mute, as he pressed the paper into my hand. "Andy, I have to ask you to wait outside. You know the drill." It took a few seconds to rouse myself, to come back into the moment and accept that this was really happening. But I was determined not to make the amateur's mistake, not to stumble and give them anything. No dumb statements blurted out under pressure in the critical early moments of the case. That is the mistake that puts people in Walpole. Is Jacob here, Andy?
No.
Do you know where he is?
No idea.
Okay, come on, buddy. Step out, please. He put his hand gently on my upper arm to encourage me, but he did not pull me out of the house. He seemed willing to wait till I was ready. He leaned in and said confidentially, "Let's do this the right way."
"It's okay, Paul.
I'm sorry. Just do your job, okay? Don't fuck it up."
"Okay. You dot those I's and cross those T's or LeJudas will throw you under the bus. He'll make you look like Barney Fife at the trial, mark my words. He'll do what he has to do. He won't protect you like I would."
"Okay, Andy. It's all right. Come on out."
I waited on the sidewalk in front of the house. Gawkers accumulated across the street, drawn by the cruisers out front. I would have preferred to wait in the backyard, out of view, but I had to be there when Laurie or Jacob got home, to comfort them and to coach them. Laurie arrived just a few minutes into the search. She wobbled when she heard the news. I steadied her and whispered into her ear not to say anything, not even to show any emotion, not fear or sadness. Give them nothing. She made a scornful sound, then she cried. Her sobbing was honest, uninhibited, as if no one was watching. She did not care what people thought, because no one had ever thought badly of her, not for one moment in her life. I knew better. We stood together in front of the house, I with my arm around her in a protective, possessive way. When the search stretched into its second hour, we retreated to the back of the house and sat on the deck. There Laurie cried softly, gathered herself, cried again. At some point, Detective Duffy came around back and climbed the stairs to the deck.
"Andy, just so you know, we found a knife this morning in the park. It was in the muck next to a lake."
"I knew it. I knew it would show up. Are there any prints, blood, anything on it?"
"Nothing obvious. It's at the lab. There was this dried algae all over it, like green powder."
"It's Patz's."
"I don't know, maybe."
"What kind of knife was it?"
"Just like a regular kitchen knife."
Laurie said, "A kitchen knife?"
"Yeah. You guys got all yours?"
I said, "Come on, Duff, be serious. What are you asking a question like that for?"
"All right, sorry. It's my job to ask."
Laurie glared.
"You guys heard from Jacob yet, Andy?"
"No, we can't find him. We've been calling everyone."
Duffy stifled a skeptical look.
"He's a kid," I said. "He disappears sometimes. When he gets here, Paul, I don't want anyone talking to him. No questions. He's a minor. He's a right to have a parent or guardian present. Don't try and pull anything."
"Jesus, Andy, nobody's going to pull anything."
"We would like to talk to him, though, obviously."
"Forget it."
"Andy, it might help him. Forget it. He's got nothing to say. Not one word."
In the middle of the yard, something caught our eyes and all three of us turned. A rabbit, tree bark gray, sniffed the air, twitched its head, alerted, relaxed. It hopped a few feet, stopped. Motionless, it blended into the grass and the gloomy light. I almost lost sight of it until it hopped a little more, a gray ripple.
Duffy turned back to Laurie.
"Only a few Saturdays before, we had all gone out to a restaurant for dinner, Duffy and his wife and Laurie and I. It seemed like another lifetime."
"We're just about done here, Laurie. We'll be out of here soon."
She nodded, too pissed off and heartbroken and betrayed to tell him it was all right.
"Paul," I told him, "he did not do it. I want to say that to you in case I don't get another chance. You and I aren't going to talk for a while, probably, so I want you to hear it right from me, okay? He did not do it. He did not do it."
"Okay, I hear you."
He turned to go.
"He's innocent as your kid."
"Okay," he said. And he left.
Over by the arbor vitae, the rabbit hunched, jaws munching. We waited until after dark for Jacob, until the cops and the voyeurs had all drifted away. He never came. He had been hiding for hours, mostly in the woods of Cold Spring Park, in backyards, and in the play structure behind the elementary school he had once attended, which is where the cops found him at around 8 o'clock. He submitted to the handcuffs without complaint, the police report said. He did not run. He greeted the cop by saying, "I'm the one you're looking for," and, "I didn't do it." When the cop said dismissively, "Then how did your fingerprint get on the body?" Jacob blurted, "foolishly or cannily, I'm still not sure." "I found him. He was already lying there. I tried to pick him up so I could help him. Then I saw he was dead, and I got scared and ran." It was the only statement Jacob ever gave the police. He must have realized, belatedly, that it was risky to blurt out confessions like that one, and he never said another word. Jacob knew, as few boys do, the full value of the Fifth Amendment. Later, there would be speculation about why Jacob made this singular statement, how complete and self-serving it was. There were intimations he had crafted the statement beforehand and conveniently let it slip. He was gaming the case, launching his defense as early as possible. All I know for sure is that Jacob was never as smart or as cunning as he was described in the media. In any case, after that, the only thing Jacob told the cop over and over was, "I want my dad." He would not be bailed that night. He was held in the lockup in Newton, just a mile or two from our house. Lori and I were allowed to see him only briefly, in a little windowless visiting room. Jacob was obviously shaken. His eyes were watery and red-rimmed. His face was flushed, a single horizontal slash of red across each cheek, like war paint. He was obviously scared shitless. At the same time, he was trying to stay composed. His manner was clenched, rigid, mechanical. A boy imitating manliness, at least an adolescent's conception of manliness. That was the part that broke my heart, I think. The way he struggled to hold it together, to keep that storm of emotion, panic, anger, sorrow, all siloed up inside himself. He would not be able to do it much longer, I thought. He was burning fuel fast.
"Jacob," Lori said in a wobbly voice, "are you all right?"
"No, obviously not." He gestured at the room around him, the situation he was in, and made a sardonic face.
"I'm dead."
"Jake, they're saying I killed Ben? No way, no way! I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe this." I said, "Hey, Jake, it's a mistake. It's some kind of horrible misunderstanding. We'll work it out, okay? I don't want you to lose hope. This is just the beginning of the process. There's a long way to go."
"I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I'm just, like..."
He made an exploding sound, and with his hands he sculpted a mushroom cloud.
"You know, it's like... Who's that guy in the story?"
"Kafka."
"No, the guy from What's It, the movie."
"I don't know, Jake."
"Where the guy, like, finds out the world isn't really the world? It's just like a dream, like a simulation, a computer made it all, and now he gets to see the real world. It's like an old movie."
"I'm not sure."
"The Matrix."
"The Matrix? That's old?"
"Keanu Reeves, Dad, please."
I looked at Lori. "Keanu Reeves?" She shrugged. It was amazing that Jake could be goofy, even now. But he was. He was the same dorky kid he had been a few hours before, had always been, for that matter.
"Dad, what am I supposed to do?"
"We're going to fight. We'll fight this every step of the way."
"No, I mean, like, not generally. Now. What happens next?"
"There'll be an arraignment tomorrow morning. They'll just read the charge, and we'll set bail, and you'll come home."
"How much is bail?"
"We'll find out tomorrow."
"What if we can't afford it? What happens to me?"
"We'll find it, don't worry. We have some money saved up. We have the house." He sniffed. He'd heard me complain about money 1,000 times.
"I'm so sorry. I didn't do it, I swear. I know I'm not, like, a perfect kid, okay? But I didn't do this."
"I believe you."
Lori added, "You are perfect, Jacob." "I didn't even know Ben. He was just like this kid from school. Why would I do this, huh? Why? Okay, why are they saying I did this?"
"I don't know, Jake."
"This is your case. What do you mean you don't know?"
"I just don't know."
"You mean you don't want to tell me?"
"No, don't say that."
"Jake, do you think I was investigating you? Really?"
He shook his head.
"So, just for no reason, for no reason, I killed Ben Rifkin? That's just, I don't know what it is, it's crazy, this whole thing is totally crazy." Jacob, you don't have to convince us. We're on your side, always, no matter what happens.
Jesus. He raked his fingers through his hair. This is Derek's fault. He did this, I know it.
Derek? Why Derek?
He gets freaked out by stuff, you know? Like the littlest things, and he freaks out about them. I swear, when I get out, I'm gonna fuck him up, I swear it.
Jake, I don't think Derek could have done this.
He did. You watch. That kid.
Lori and I exchanged a puzzled look.
Jake, we're going to get you out of here. We'll put up the bail, whatever it is. We'll find the money. We're not going to let you sit in jail. But you're going to have to spend the night here, just until the arraignment in the morning. We'll meet you at the courthouse first thing. We'll have a lawyer with us. You'll be home for dinner tomorrow. Tomorrow you're going to sleep in your own bed, I promise.
I don't want a lawyer. I want you. You be my lawyer. Who could be better?
I can't.
Why not? I want you. You're my father. I need you now.
It's a bad idea, Jacob. You need a defense lawyer. Anyway, it's all taken care of. I called my friend Jonathan Klein. He's very, very good, I promise you.
He frowned, disappointed.
Well, you couldn't do it anyway. You're a DA.
Not anymore.
You got fired?
Not yet. I'm on leave. They'll fire me later, probably.
'Cause of me?
No, not 'cause of you. You didn't do anything. It's just the way things go.
So what are you going to do? Like, for money, you need a job.
Don't worry about money. Let me worry about money.
A cop, some young kid I did not know, knocked and said, "Time."
Lori told Jacob, "We love you. We love you so much."
"Okay, Mom."
She wrapped her arms around him. For a moment he did not move at all, and Lori stood there hugging him as if she had embraced a tree or a building column. Finally he relented and patted her back.
"Do you know it, Jake? Do you know how much we love you?"
Over her shoulder he rolled his eyes.
"Yes, Mom. Okay."
She pulled herself away and swiped the tears from her eyes.
"Okay, then."
Jacob seemed to tremble on the verge of crying as well. I hugged him. I pulled him close, squeezed hard, then stepped back. I looked him over from head to toe. There was mud ground into the knees of his jeans from the hours he had spent hiding in Cold Spring Park in a rainy April. "You be strong, okay?"
"You too," he said.
He grinned, apparently catching the dopiness of his answer. We left him there. And still, the night was not over. At 2 a.m., I was in the living room, slumped on the couch. I felt marooned, unable to move my body up to the bedroom or to fall asleep where I was. Lori padded down the stairs barefoot, in pajama bottoms and a favorite turquoise T-shirt that was now too threadbare for anything but sleeping in. Her breasts drooped inside it, defeated by age, gravity. Her hair was a mess, her eyes half shut. The sight of her nearly brought me to tears. From the third step, she said,
"Andy, come to bed. There's nothing more we can do tonight."
"Soon."
"Not soon. Now. Come."
"Lori, come here. There's something we have to talk about."
She shuffled across the front hall to join me in the living room, and in those dozen steps, she seemed to come fully awake. I was not the type to ask for help often. When I did, it alarmed her.
"What is it, sweetheart?"
"Sit down. There's something I have to tell you, something that's going to come out soon."
"About Jacob?"
"About me." I told her everything, all that I knew about my bloodline, about James Burkett, the first bloody barber, who came east from the frontier like a reverse pioneer bringing his wildness to New York, and Rusty Barber, my war hero grandfather who wound up gutting a man in a fight over a traffic accident in Lowell, Massachusetts, and my own father, Bloody Billy Barber, whose shadowy climactic orgy of violence involved a young girl and a knife in an abandoned building. After 34 years of waiting, the whole story took only 5 or 10 minutes to tell. Once it was out, it seemed like a puny thing to have found so burdensome for so long, and I was confident, briefly, that Lori would see it that way, too.
"That's what I come from."
She nodded, blank-faced, doped with disappointment. in me, in my history, in my dishonesty. Andy, why didn't you ever tell me?
Because it didn't matter. It was never who I was. I'm not like them.
But you didn't trust me to understand that.
No, Lori, it's not about that.
You just never got around to it?
No. At the beginning, I didn't want you to think of me that way. Then the longer it went, the less it seemed to matter. We were so happy.
Until now, when you had to tell me, you had no choice.
Lori, I want you to know about it because it's probably going to come out. Not because it really has anything to do with this, but because shit like this always comes out. It has nothing to do with Jacob or me.
You're sure of that?
I died for a moment. Then, yes, I'm sure.
So sure that you felt you had to hide it from me.
No, that's not right.
Anything else you haven't told me?
No.
You're sure?
Yes. She thought it over.
Okay, then.
Okay, meaning what? Do you have any questions? Do you want to talk?
She gave me a reproachful look. I was asking her if she wanted to talk at 2 in the morning, on this morning.
Lori, nothing is different. This doesn't change anything. I'm the same person you've known since we were 17.
Okay.
She looked down at her lap where her hands were wrestling.
You should have told me before, that's all I can say right now.
I had a right to know. I had a right to know who I was marrying, who I was having a child with.
You did know. You married me. All this other stuff is just history. It's got nothing to do with us.
You should have told me, that's all. I had a right to know.
If I'd told you, you wouldn't have married me. You wouldn't have gone out with me in the first place.
You don't know that. You never gave me the chance.
Oh, come on. If I'd asked you out and you knew?
I don't know what I would have said.
I do.
Why?
Because girls like you don't settle for boys like that. Look, let's just forget it.
How do you know, Andy? How do you know what I'd choose?
You're right, I don't. I'm sorry.
There was a lull, and it could have been all right still. At that moment, we could still have survived it and moved on.
I knelt in front of her, rested my arms on her lap, on her warm legs.
Lori, I'm sorry. I'm truly sorry I didn't tell you.
But I can't undo that now. The important thing is I need to know you understand. My father, my grandfather, I'm not them. I need to know you believe that.
I do. I mean, I guess I do. Of course I do. I don't know, Andy, it's late. I have to get some sleep. I can't do this now. I'm too tired.
Lori, you know me. Look at me. You know me.
She studied my face.
From this close, I was surprised to discover she looked rather old and exhausted, and I thought it had been selfish of me and a little cruel to unload this on her now, in the middle of the night after the worst day of her life, just to get it off my chest, to ease my own mind. And I remembered her. I remembered the girl with brown legs, sitting on a beach towel on old campus freshman year. The girl so far out of my league that she was actually easy to talk to, because there was nothing to lose. At 17, I knew. My entire childhood had been just a prelude to this girl. I had never felt anything like it, and still haven't. I felt changed by her, physically. Not sexually, though we had sex everywhere, like minks, in the library stacks, in an empty classroom, her car, her family's beach house, even a cemetery. It was more. I became a different person, myself, the person I am now. And everything that came after, my family, my home, our entire life together, was a gift she gave me. The spell lasted 34 years. Now, at 51, I saw her as she actually was, finally. It came as a surprise. No longer the shining girl. She was just a woman, after all.
Part 2.
That murder might be any business of the state is a relatively modern idea. For most of human history, homicide has been a purely private affair. In traditional societies, a killing was simply the occasion for a dispute between two clans. The killer's family or tribe was expected to resolve the dispute equitably by some sort of offering to the victim's family or tribe. The restitution varied from society to society. It might involve anything from a fine to the death of the murderer, or a stand-in. If the victim's kin was unsatisfied, a blood feud might ensue. This pattern endured across many centuries and many societies. Current practice notwithstanding, by long tradition, murder has been strictly a family matter. Joseph Eisen, Murder, A History, 1949. Chapter 9. Arraignment. The next morning, Jonathan Klein stood with Laurie and me in the gloom of the Thorndike Street garage as we armored ourselves against the reporters gathered at the courthouse door just down the street. Klein wore a gray suit with his usual black turtleneck. No tie today, even for court. The suit, particularly the pants, hung loosely off him. He must have been a tailor's nightmare with his thin, assless body. Reading glasses hung from an Indian bead lanyard around his neck. He carried his ancient cowhide briefcase, worn slick as an old saddle. To an outsider, no doubt, Klein would have seemed inadequate to the job. Too small, too meek. But something about him was reassuring to me. With his back-swept white hair, white goatee, and benevolent smile, I thought there was a magical quality about him. A sense of calm surrounded him. Lord knows we needed it. Klein peeked down the block at the reporters who loafed and chatted, a wolf pack sniffing about for something to do. "All right," he said. "Andy, I know you've been through this before, but never from this side. Laurie, this will all be new to you, so I'm going to read you the catechism, both of you." He extended his hand to touch Laurie's sleeve. She looked devastated by the double shocks of the day before, Jacob's arrest and the barber curse. We had spoken very little in the morning as we ate, dressed, and got ready for court. It crossed my mind for the first time that we were headed for divorce. However the trial turned out, Laurie would leave me when it was over. I could tell she was eyeing me, making up her mind. What did it mean to find out that she had been tricked into marrying me? Should she feel betrayed, or acknowledge that her uneasiness meant I was right all along? Girls like her don't marry boys like me. In any event, Jonathan's touch seemed to comfort her. She manufactured a brief little smile for him, then a bleary look returned to her face. Klein. From this moment on, from the time we arrive at the courthouse until you get back home tonight and close the door of your house, I want you to show nothing, no emotion at all. Keep a poker face, got it? Laurie did not respond. She seemed dazed. I'm a potted plant, I assured him. Good. Because every expression, every reaction, every flicker of emotion will be interpreted against you. Laugh, and they'll say you don't take the proceedings seriously. Scowl, and they'll say you're surly, you're not contrite, you resent being hauled into court. Cry, and you're faking. He looked at Laurie. Okay, she said, less sure of herself, particularly of this last item. Don't answer any questions. You don't have to. On TV, only the pictures matter. It is impossible to tell whether you heard a question that someone shouted at you. Most important, and I'll speak to Jacob about this when I get to the lockup, any sign of anger from Jacob in particular will confirm people's worst suspicions. You have to remember, in their eyes, in everybody's eyes, Jacob is guilty. You all are. They only want something to confirm what they already know. Any little scrap will do. Laurie said, It's a little late to be worried about our public image, isn't it? That morning, the Globe had run a page one headline, DA's teen son charged in Newton killing. The Herald was sensational, but to its credit, forthright. Its tabloid cover showed a background photo of what appeared to be the murder scene, an empty slope in a forest, with a snapshot of Jacob that they must have culled from the web, and the word monster. There was a teaser at the bottom. Prosecutor benched amid allegations of cover-up as his own teenage son is unmasked in Newton knife murder. Laurie had a point. After that, maintaining a poker face as we walked into court did seem a little inadequate. But Klein only shrugged. The rules were beyond question. They might as well have been written on stone tablets by the finger of God. He said in his quiet, common-sense way, "We'll do the most we can with what we have." So we did as we were told. We kept our feet moving through the proxy mob of reporters waiting for us in front of the courthouse. We showed no emotion, answered no questions, pretended we did not hear the questions as they were yelled in our ears. They kept on shouting questions anyway. Microphones bristled and probed around us. "How are you doing? What do you say to all the people who trusted you? Anything to say to the victim's family? Did Jacob do it? We just want to hear your side. Will he testify?" One, trying to provoke, said, "Mr. Barber, how does it feel to be on the other side?" I held Lori's hand and we pushed through into the lobby. Things were surprisingly quiet, even normal, inside. Reporters were barred here. At the lobby security station, people stood back to let us pass. The sheriff's officers who used to wave me through with a smile now wanded me and inspected the change from my pocket. We were alone again, briefly, in the elevator. As we rode to the sixth floor, where the first session courtroom was, I reached for Lori's hand, my fingers scrabbling against hers to find a fit. My wife was a good deal shorter than I, so in order to hold her hand, I had to haul it up to the level of my hip. She was left with her elbow bent, as if she were checking her watch. A look of distaste crossed her face. Her eyelids fluttered, her lips tightened. It was barely perceptible, a micro-movement, but I noticed and released her hand. The elevator doors shivered as the box was lifted. Klein kept his eyes on the panel of ranked buttons, tactfully. When the doors rattled open, we marched through the crowded lobby to courtroom 6B, there to wait on the front center bench until our case was called. An awkward interval passed before the judge took the bench. We had been told our case would be called promptly at 10 so the court could deal with us and the circus of reporters and gawkers, then quickly get back to business. We arrived at the courtroom around quarter of. Time dragged while we waited. It felt like a lot more than 15 minutes. The crowds of lawyers, most of whom I knew well, stood back as if there were a magnetic field around us. Paul Duffy was there, standing against the far wall with LeJudas and a couple of the CPAC guys. Duffy, who was essentially an uncle to Jacob, glanced at me once as we sat down, then turned away. I was not offended. I did not feel shunned. There was an etiquette to these things, that's all. Duffy had to support the home team. That was his job. Maybe we would become friends again after Jacob was cleared. Maybe we wouldn't. For now, the friendship was suspended. No hard feelings, but that was the way it had to be. I know that Lori was not so bloodless about Duffy's snubs or anyone else's. To her, it was awful to see friendships snapped off this way. We were the same people after that we had been before, and because we had not changed, it was easy for her to forget that others saw us, all of us, not just Jacob, in a completely new way. At a minimum, Lori felt, people ought to see that whatever Jacob may have done, she and I were certainly innocent. It was a delusion I never shared. Courtroom 6B had an extra jury box to accommodate large jury pools, and that morning in the empty extra jury box, a TV camera was set up to provide a shared video feed to all the local stations. While we waited, the cameraman kept the lens pointed at us. We wore our defendants' blank masks, said nothing to each other, barely even blinked. It is not an easy thing to be watched for so long. I began to notice little things, as one does during extended downtimes. I studied my own hands, which were big and pale, with prominent scuffed knuckles. Not a lawyer's hands, I thought. Strange to see them appended to my own coat sleeves. That quarter hour of waiting and being stared at in the courtroom, a courtroom I once owned, a room as comfortable to me as my own kitchen, was even worse than what followed. At 10, the first session judge swept in wearing her black robe. Judge Rivera, a terrible judge, but a good break for us. You must understand, Courtroom 6B, the first session court, was a hardship post for judges. They rotated in and out of it every few months. It was the job of the first session judge to make the trains run on time, to assign cases to the other courtrooms in such a way that the workload was spread evenly, to winnow the docket by cajoling plea bargains out of reluctant ADAs and defendants, and to sort through the remaining administrative busywork on the daily docket as efficiently as possible. It was a hectic job, delegate, dump, defer. Lourdes Rivera was 50-ish, with a frazzled demeanor and magnificently miscast as the judge to make the trains run on time. It was all she could do to get herself to court on time with her robe zipped up and her cell phone turned off. The lawyers scorned her. They grumbled about how she got the job because of her good looks or her opportune marriage to a politically connected lawyer or to plump up the number of Latinos on the bench. They called her Lardass Rivera. But we could have hardly picked a better judge that morning. Judge Rivera had been on the Superior Court bench less than 5 years, but already she had a towering reputation in the district attorney's office as a defendant's judge. Most of the judges in Cambridge had the same reputation, soft, unrealistic, liberal. Now it seemed perfectly appropriate to load the dice that way. A liberal, it turns out, is a conservative who's been indicted. When the clerk called Jacob's case, indictment number 08-4407, Commonwealth versus Jacob Michael Barber, one count of murder in the first degree. My son was ushered in by two court officers from the lockup and made to stand in the middle of the courtroom in front of the jury box. He scanned the crowd, saw us, and immediately dropped his eyes to the floor. Embarrassed and awkward, he began to fuss with his suit and tie, which Lori had picked out for him and Klein had delivered. Jacob was not used to wearing a suit, and he seemed to feel both dapper and straitjacketed. He had already begun to outgrow the coat. Lori used to joke that he was growing so fast that at night when the house was quiet, she could hear his bones stretching. Now he fidgeted to make the coat sit properly on his shoulders, but it would not stretch that far. From all this fidgeting, reporters would later say that Jacob was vain, that he even enjoyed his moment in the spotlight, a slur we would hear over and over when the trial actually began. The truth was, he was an awkward boy and so thoroughly terrified that he did not know where to put his hands. The wonder was that he managed to stand there with as much composure as he did. Jonathan passed through the swinging gate in the bar, laid his briefcase on the defense table, and took a position beside Jacob. He put his hand on Jacob's back, not for Jacob's benefit, but to make a point. "This boy is no monster. I am not afraid to touch him. And more, I am not simply a hired gun doing my professional duty for a distasteful client. I believe in this kid. I am his friend." "Commonwealth," Lardass Rivera said, "I'll hear you." LeJudas stood up at the prosecutor's table. He ran his palm down the length of his tie, then reached around to give the back hem of his coat a little tug. "Your Honor," he began mournfully, "this is a heinous case." He pronounced the word heinous, and I understood that the actual reason courtrooms often have no windows is to prevent the parties from heaving lawyers out of them. LeJudas recited the facts of the case, already familiar to everyone from the last 24 hours of news reports, retold now with a minimum of embellishment for the torches and pitchforks mob beyond the camera. There was even a little sing-song in his voice, as if we had all heard these facts often enough to be bored by them. But when he reached his bail argument, LeJudas's tone became somber. "Your Honor, we all know and have fond feelings for the defendant's father, who is in the courtroom today. I personally have known this man, respected and admired him. I have great affection for this man, and compassion, as we all do, I'm sure. Always the smartest man in the room. Things came so easily to him. But, objection. Sustained." LeJudas turned to look at me, not by twisting his body, but by snaking his neck around his own shoulder. "Things came so easily to him." Could he really have believed that? "Mr. LeJudas," Lardass said, "I presume you know Andrew Barber is not accused of anything." LeJudas faced front again. "Yes, Your Honor." "Let's get to the bail, then." "Your Honor, the Commonwealth is seeking a very high bail, 500,000 cash, 5 million surety. The Commonwealth would argue that because of the unusual circumstances of his family situation, this defendant poses a particular risk of flight in light of the savagery of the crime, the overwhelming likelihood of conviction, and the unusual sophistication of this defendant who has grown up in a home where criminal law is the family business." LeJudas went on with his horseshit for a few minutes. He seemed to have memorized his lines and was delivering them now without any particular feeling. In my head, the odd mention of me went right on playing like a counter melody. I have great affection for this man and compassion. Always the smartest man in the room. Things came so easily to him.
In the courtroom, it seemed to have been received almost as a slip of the tongue, a sniffly little tribute blurted out in the spur of the moment. They were touched. They had watched this scene before. The disillusioned young apprentice sees his mentor revealed as an ordinary man or otherwise brought low, the scales fall from his eyes, etc., etc. Bullshit. Lajudas was not the type to make extemporaneous speeches, not with the camera running. I imagine he practiced this line before a mirror. The only question was what he expected to get out of it, how exactly he meant to sink the knife into Jacob. In the end, Lardass Rivera was unmoved by Lajudas's bail argument. She set the bail where it had been since the day he was arrested, at a measly 10 grand, a token number reflecting the fact that Jacob had nowhere to run and, after all, his family was known to the court. Lajudas shrugged off the defeat. His bail argument was nothing but grandstanding anyway. "Your Honor," he barreled on, "the Commonwealth would also raise an objection to the entry of an appearance by Mr. Klein as defense counsel in this case. Mr. Klein was previously engaged as attorney for another suspect in this homicide, a man whose name I will not mention in open court. To represent a second defendant in the same case creates a clear conflict of interest. Defense counsel would surely have been privy to confidential information from this other suspect that might impact the defense in this case. I can only imagine that the defendant is planting the seed for an appeal based on ineffective assistance if he is convicted." The suggestion of a sneaky trick pulled Jonathan to his feet. It was exceptionally rare for one lawyer to attack another so openly. Even in the scrum of a bitter trial, in court a formal clubby politeness was always maintained. Jonathan was genuinely insulted. "Your Honor, if the Commonwealth had taken the time to ascertain the actual facts, he would never have made that accusation. The fact is, I was never retained by the other suspect in this case, nor did I ever have any conversation with him about it. This was a client I represented years ago on an unrelated matter who called me out of the blue to come to the Newton police station where he was being questioned. My sole involvement with him in this case was to advise that he not answer any questions. As he was never accused, I never spoke to him again. I was not privy to any information, confidential or otherwise, now or in any previous matter that bears on this case even remotely. There is no conflict of interest at all." "Your Honor," Lajudas said with an unctuous shrug, "as an officer of the court, it is my duty to report an issue like this. If Mr. Klein is offended—" "Is it your duty to deny the defendant the counsel of his choosing, or to call him a liar before the case even begins?" "All right," Lardass said, "both of you. Mr. Lajudas, the Commonwealth's objection to the entry of Mr. Klein's appearance as counsel is noted and overruled." She glanced up from her papers and eyed him over the top of the judge's bench. "Don't get carried away." Lajudas limited his response to a pantomime of disagreement, a tip of the head, eyebrows raised, so as not to provoke the judge. But in the shadow trial of public opinion, he had probably scored a point. In the next day's papers, on talk radio, on the internet chat boards that dissected the case, they would be discussing whether Jacob Barber was trying to pull a fast one. Anyway, it was never Lajudas's intention to be liked. "I'm sending this case out to Judge French for trial," Lardass Rivera said with finality. She flipped the file toward the clerk. "We'll recess for 10 minutes. She frowned at the cameraman and the reporters in the back and, I may have imagined this, at Lajudas. The bail was arranged quickly and Jacob was released to us. Together, we left the courthouse through a gauntlet of reporters that seemed to have grown since we arrived. Grown more aggressive, too. Out on Thorndike Street, they tried to stop us by standing in our path. Somebody, it may have been a reporter, though no one saw him, pushed Jacob in the chest, knocking him back a few steps, trying to elicit a response. Jacob gave none. His blank face never wavered. Even the more polite ones had a slippery tactic to get us to stop and talk. They asked, "Can you just tell us what happened in there?" As if they did not know, as if the whole thing had not been broadcast to them via the live video feed and text messages from their colleagues. By the time we rounded the corner and drove up to our home, we were exhausted. Lori in particular looked wrung out. Her hair was beginning to craze in the humidity. Her face looked drawn.
Since the catastrophe, she had been losing weight steadily and her lovely heart-shaped face was becoming gaunt. As I began to turn the car into the driveway, Lori gasped, "Oh my God!" and clapped her hand over her mouth. There was graffiti on the front of our house, drawn with a thick black marker. "Murderer, we hate you. Rot in hell." The letters were big, blocky, and neat, written in no particular haste. Our house was faced with tan shingles, and the edges of these shingles caused the pen to skip as it crossed from one to the next. Otherwise, it had been done carefully, in broad daylight, while we were gone. The graffiti had not been there when we left that morning, I'm sure of that. I looked up and down the street. The sidewalks were empty. Down the block, a gardening crew had parked a truck, and their mowers and leaf blowers buzzed loudly. No sign of neighbors. No people at all. Just neat green lawns, rhododendrons blooming pink and purple, a cordon of big old maples running the length of the block, shading the street. Lori jumped out and ran into the house, leaving Jacob and me to stare at the graffiti. "Don't let them get to you, Jake. They're just trying to scare you." "I know. This is just one idiot. That's all it takes, is one idiot. It's not everyone. It's not how people feel." "Yes, it is." "Not everyone." "Of course it is. It's okay, Dad. I don't really care." I twisted to look at him in the back seat. "Really? This doesn't bother you?" "No." He sat with his arms crossed, eyes narrow, lips tight. "If it did, you'd tell me, right?" "I guess. Because it's okay to feel hurt. You know that." He frowned disdainfully and shook his head, like an emperor declining to grant an indulgence. "They can't hurt me." "So tell me, what are you feeling inside, Jake, right now, this minute?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing? That's not possible."
"Like you said, it's just one asshole, one idiot, whatever. I mean, it's not like kids have never said anything bad about me, Dad. They do it to my face. What do you think school is? This,"
he gestured with his chin toward the graffiti on the house,
"this is just a different platform."
I gazed at him a moment. He did not move, except that his eyes traveled from me to the passenger window. I patted his knee, though it was awkward to reach, and the best I could manage was to tap my fingertip against the hard bone of his kneecap. It occurred to me that I had given him the wrong advice the night before, when I had told him to be strong. I was telling him in so many words to be like me. But now that I saw he had taken my words to heart and swaddled himself in theatrical toughness, like an adolescent Clint Eastwood, I regretted the comment. I wanted the other Jacob, my goofy, awkward son, to show his face again. But it was too late. Anyway, his tough guy act was oddly moving to me. "You're a great kid, Jake. I'm proud of you. I mean, the way you stood up there today, now this. You're a good kid." He snorted.
"Yeah, okay, Dad."
Inside, I found Lori on her hands and knees rummaging through the cleaning supplies in the cabinet under the kitchen sink. She was still wearing the navy skirt she wore to court.
"Just leave it, Lori. I'll take care of it. You go rest."
"You'll take care of it when?"
"Whenever you want."
"You say you'll take care of things and then you don't. I don't want that thing on my house, not for one more minute. I'm not going to just leave it there."
"I said I'll take care of it. Please, go rest."
"How can I rest, Andy, with that thing? Honestly. Did you see what they wrote? On our home. On our home, Andy, and you want me to just go rest? Great. This is just great. They walk right up and right on our house and nobody says anything. Nobody lifts a finger. Not one of our fucking neighbors."
She enunciated the expletive meticulously, right down to the final G, as people who are not used to swearing often do.
"We should call the cops. It's a crime, isn't it? It is a crime. I know it is. It's vandalism. Should we call the cops?"
"No, we're not calling the cops."
"No, of course not."
She came up with a bottle of Fantastic, then snatched up a dish towel and soaked it under the faucet.
"Lori, please, let me do this. Let me help you at least. Would you just stop? I said I'll do it."
She had taken off her shoes and she marched out like that, barefoot in her nylons, and scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed. I went out with her, but there was nothing for me to do except watch. Her hair bounced to the vigorous movements of her arm. Her eyes were wet, and her face flushed. "Can I help, Lori?"
"No, I'll do it."
At length I gave up watching and went back in. I heard her scruffing against the side of the house for a long time. She succeeded in rubbing out the words, but the ink left a gray cloud on the paint. It is still there today. Chapter 10 Leopards. Jonathan's office was a little warren of cluttered rooms in a century-old Victorian near Harvard Square. The practice was essentially a one-man operation. He did have an associate, a young woman named Ellen Curtis, who was just out of Suffolk Law. But he used her only as a stand-in on days when he could not be in court himself, usually because he was held on trial elsewhere, and to handle basic legal research. It was understood, apparently, that Ellen would move on when she was ready to launch her own practice. For now, she was a vaguely disconcerting presence in the office, a mostly silent, dark-eyed observer of the clients who came and went, the murderers, rapists, thieves, child molesters, tax evaders, and all their cursed families. There was a bit of Northampton about her, a bit of the college kid's orthodox radicalism. I imagined she judged Jacob harshly. The suburban rich kid who pissed away all the advantages he had lucked into, something like that. But her behavior gave nothing away. Ellen treated us with elaborate politeness. She insisted on calling me Mr. Barber and offered to take my coat whenever I showed up, as if any hint of intimacy would undermine her neutral pose. The only other member of Jonathan's team was Mrs. Wirtz, who kept the books, answered the phone, and when she could no longer stand the mess, reluctantly scrubbed the kitchen and bathroom while murmuring murder under her breath. She bore an uncanny resemblance to my mother. The best room in the office was the library. It had a red brick fireplace and bookcases lined with familiar old law books, the honey bindings of the Massachusetts and federal case reports, the army green mass appeals reports, the wine red of the old mass practice series. It was in this warm little den that we gathered just a few hours after Jacob's arraignment in early afternoon to discuss the case. We three barbers sat around an old circular oak table with Jonathan. Ellen was there too, scribbling notes on a yellow legal pad. Jacob wore a burgundy hoodie that had the logo of a clothing company on the chest, a silhouette of a rhino. As the meeting began, he slumped in his chair with the cavernous hood over his head like a druid. I told him, "Jacob, take your hood off. Don't be disrespectful." He slipped it off with a sulky flip and sat there with an absent expression, as if the meeting was a matter for grown-ups that held little interest for him. Lori, in her sexy schoolmarm glasses and a lightweight fleece pullover, looked like a thousand other suburban soccer moms, except for the shock-hammered look in her eyes. She asked for a legal pad of her own and gamely made ready to take notes along with Ellen. Lori seemed determined to keep her head, to think her way out of the maze, to remain clear-headed and industrious even in this surreal dream. She might have had an easier time of it, honestly, if she had not been so engaged. The stupid and belligerent have it easy in these situations. They can simply stop thinking and gird for battle, trust to the experts and to fate, insisting that everything will turn out right in the end. Lori was neither stupid nor belligerent, and in the end she paid an awful price. But I'm getting ahead of the story. For the moment, seeing her with her pad and pen inevitably reminded me of our college days, when Lori was a bit of a grind, at least compared to me. We rarely took classes together. Our interests were not the same. I was drawn to history, Lori to psych, English, and film. And anyway, we did not want to become one of those nauseating, inseparable couples that mooned around campus side by side like Siamese twins. In 4 years, the one class we shared was Edmund Morgan's Intro to Early American History, which we took freshman year when we'd just started dating. I used to steal Lori's notebook before exams to catch up on the lectures I'd skipped. I remember gaping at her class notes, page after page of neat cursive. She captured long phrases from the lectures verbatim, broke the lectures down into branching concepts and subconcepts, added her own thoughts as she went. There were few of the cross-outs or scribbles or snaking arrows that filled my sloppy, frantic, clownish class notes. In fact, That notebook from Edmund Morgan's lectures was part of the revelation of meeting Lori. What struck me was not just that she was probably smarter than me. Coming from a small town, Watertown, New York, I was prepared for that. I fully expected Yale to be swarming with brainy, worldly kids like Lori Gold. I had studied up on them by reading Salinger stories and watching Love Story and The Paper Chase. No, the epiphany I had looking at Lori's notebook was not that she was smart, but that she was unknowable. She was every bit as complex as I was. As a kid, I had always believed there was a special drama about being Andy Barber, but the interior experience of being Lori Gold must have been just as fraught with secrets and sorrows. She would always be a mystery, as all other people are. Try as I might to penetrate her by talking, kissing, stabbing myself into her, the best I would ever do was to know her just a little. It is a childish realization, I admit. No one worth knowing can be quite known. No one worth possessing can be quite possessed. But after all, we were children. Well, Jonathan said, looking up from his papers, this is just the initial package from Neil LaJudas. All I have here is the indictment and some of the police reports, so obviously we don't have all the prosecution's evidence yet. But we have a general picture of the case against Jacob. We can begin talking, at least, and try to get a general picture of what the trial will look like. We can start to figure out what we need to do between now and then. Jacob, before we begin, I want to say a couple of things to you in particular. Okay. First, you're the client here. That means that as far as possible, you are the decision maker. Not your parents, not me, not anyone else. This is your case. You are always in control. Nothing is going to happen here that you don't agree with, okay? Okay. To the extent you want to leave the decision-making up to your mom and dad or to me, that's perfectly understandable. But you should not feel like you don't have a say in your own case. The law is treating you as an adult. For better or worse, by law in Massachusetts, every kid your age charged with first-degree murder is charged as an adult. So I'm going to do my best to treat you as an adult, too. Okay? Jacob said, "Kay." Not a wasted syllable. If Jonathan was expecting an outpouring of gratitude, he had the wrong kid. The other thing is, I don't want you to feel overwhelmed. I want to warn you, in every case like this, there's an oh-shit moment. That's when you look up at the case against you, you see all the evidence, all the people on the DA's team, you hear all the things the DA is saying in court, and you panic. You feel hopeless. Deep down, a little voice says, "Oh, shit." I want you to understand it happens every time. If it hasn't hit you yet, it will. And what I want you to remember when that oh shit feeling hits is that we have enough resources right here in this room to win. There's no reason to panic. It does not matter how big the DA's team is, it doesn't matter how strong the DA's case looks, or how confident LaJudas seems. We are not outgunned. We do need to stay cool. And if we do, we have everything we need to win. Now, do you believe that? I don't know. Not really, I guess. Well, I'm telling you it's true. Jacob's eyes dropped to his lap. A micro-expression, a disappointed pucker, fluttered across Jonathan's face. So much for the pep talk. Giving up, he slipped on his half-moon glasses and paged through the papers in front of him, mostly photocopies of police reports and the statement of the case filed by LaJudas, which laid out the essentials of the government's evidence. Without his jacket, wearing the same black turtleneck he'd worn in court, Jonathan's shoulders looked slight and bony. "The theory," he said, "seems to be that Ben Rifkin was bullying you. Therefore, you got a knife, and when the opportunity presented itself, or perhaps when the victim bullied you one time too many, you took your revenge. There don't seem to be any direct witnesses. A woman who was walking in Cold Spring Park places you in the area that morning. Another walker in the park heard the victim cry out, 'Stop, you're hurting me,' but she didn't actually see anything. And a fellow student," that's LaJudas's phrase, "a fellow student, alleges you had a knife. That fellow student is not named in the reports I have here. Jacob, any idea who that is?" "It's Derek. Derek Yu." "Why do you say that?" "He said the same thing on Facebook. He's been saying it for a while."
Jonathan nodded, but did not ask the obvious question. Is it true?
Well, he said, it's a very circumstantial case. There's the thumbprint, which I want to talk about. But fingerprints are a very limited kind of evidence. There's no way to tell exactly when or how a fingerprint got there. There's often an innocent explanation.
He dropped this remark in an offhand way, without looking up. I squirmed.
Laurie said, there is something else.
A beat, a curious feeling in the room.
Laurie glanced around the table apprehensively. Her voice was momentarily husky, congested.
What if they say Jacob inherited something, like a disease?
I don't understand. Inherited what?
Violence.
Jacob.
What? I don't know if my husband has told you. There is a history of violence in our family. Apparently.
I noticed that she said our family, plural. I clung to that to prevent myself from falling off a cliff.
Jonathan sat back and slipped off his glasses, let them dangle from the lanyard. He looked at her with a puzzled expression.
Not Andy and me, Laurie said. Jacob's grandfather, his great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, etc.
Jacob.
Mom, what are you talking about?
I'm just wondering, could they say Jacob has a tendency, a genetic tendency?
What sort of tendency?
To violence.
A genetic tendency to violence?
No, of course not.
Jonathan shook his head. Then his curiosity got the better of him.
Whose father and grandfather are we talking about?
Mine. I felt myself redden, the warmth rising in my cheeks, my ears. I was ashamed, then ashamed at feeling ashamed, at my lack of self-command, then ashamed again that Jonathan was watching my son learn of this in real time, exposing me as a liar, a bad father. Only last was I ashamed in my son's eyes.
Jonathan looked away from me, pointedly, allowing me to recover myself.
No, Laurie, that sort of evidence would definitely not be admissible.
Anyway, as far as I know, there is no such thing as a genetic tendency to violence. If Andy really does have violence in his family background, then his own good nature and his life prove that the tendency doesn't exist.
He glanced at me to be sure I heard the confidence in his voice.
It's not Andy that I doubt. It's the DA, LeJudas. What if he finds out?
I Googled it this morning. There have been cases where this sort of DNA evidence has been used. They say it makes the defendant aggressive. They called it the murder gene.
That's ridiculous. The murder gene. You certainly did not find any cases like that in Massachusetts.
No.
I volunteered. Jonathan, she's upset. We just talked about this last night. It's my fault. I shouldn't have put all this on her right now.
Laurie held herself erect to demonstrate how wrong I was. She was in control, not reacting wildly out of emotion.
In a comforting tone, Jonathan said, Laurie, all I can tell you is that if they do try to raise that as an issue, we'll fight it tooth and nail. It's insane.
Jonathan snorted and shook his head, which for a soft-spoken guy like him was a rather violent outburst. And even now, looking back on that moment when the idea of a murder gene was first raised, by Laurie of all people, I feel my back stiffen. I feel the anger ooze up my spine. The murder gene was not just a contemptible idea and a slander, though it absolutely was both of those things. It also offended me as a lawyer. I saw right away the backwardness of it, the way it warped the real science of DNA and the genetic component of behavior, and overlaid it with the junk science of sleazy lawyers, the cynical, science-like language whose actual purpose was to manipulate juries, to fool them with the sheen of scientific certainty. The murder gene was a lie, a lawyer's con game. It was also a deeply subversive idea. It undercut the whole premise of the criminal law. In court, the thing we punish is the criminal intention, the mens rea, the guilty mind. There is an ancient rule. Actus non facit reum nisi mens sit rea. The act does not create guilt unless the mind is also guilty. That is why we do not convict children, drunks, and schizophrenics,
They are incapable of deciding to commit their crimes with a true understanding of the significance of their actions. Free will is as important to the law as it is to religion or any other code of morality. We do not punish the leopard for its wildness. Would LeJudas have the balls to make the argument anyway? Born bad? I was sure he would try. Whether or not it was good science or good law, he would whisper it in the jury's ear like a gossip passing a secret. He would find a way. In the end, Lori was right, of course. The murder gene would haunt us, if not quite the way she anticipated. But in that first meeting, Jonathan and I, trained in the humanist tradition of the law, instinctively rejected it. We laughed it off. The idea had got a hold of Lori's imagination, though, and Jacob's too. My son's jaw literally hung open. Is somebody going to tell me what you guys are talking about? Jake, I began. But the words did not come. What? Somebody tell me. My father is in prison. He has been for a long time. But you never knew your father. That's not entirely true. But you said. You've always said. I did. I said. I'm sorry for that. I never really knew him, that was true. But I knew who he was. You lied to me? I didn't tell you the whole truth. You lied. I shook my head. All the reasons, all the things I had felt as a kid seemed ridiculous and inadequate now. I don't know. Jeez, what did he do? Deep breath. He killed a girl. How? Why? What happened? I don't really want to talk about it. You don't want to talk about it? No shit, you don't want to talk about it. He was a bad guy, Jacob, that's all. Just leave it at that. How come you never told me? Jacob, Lori cut in softly, I never knew either. I only found out last night. She laid her hand on Jacob's and rustled it. It's okay. We're still kind of figuring out how to process all this. Try to stay calm, okay? It's just... it can't be true. How come you never told me? This is my, what, my grandfather? How could you keep that from me? Who do you think you are? Jacob, watch how you talk to your father. No, it's okay, Lori. He's got a right to be upset. I am upset. Jacob, I never told you. I never told anyone because I was afraid people would look at me differently. And now I'm afraid it's how people are going to look at you, too. I didn't want that to happen. Someday, maybe someday very soon, you'll understand. He gawped at me, unsatisfied. I didn't mean for it to come to all this. I wanted to move past it. But, Dad, it's who I am. That's not how I looked at it. I had a right to know. That's not how I looked at it, Jake. I didn't have a right to know about my own family. You had a right to not know. You had a right to start with a blank slate, to be whatever you wanted to be, same as every other kid. But I wasn't the same as every other kid. Of course you were. Lori looked away. Jacob tossed himself backward in his chair. He seemed more shocked than aggrieved. The questions, the complaints, were just a way to channel his emotion. He sat there a while, deep in thought. I don't believe it, he said, bewildered. I just don't believe it. I don't believe you did that. Look, Jacob, if you want to be mad at me for lying, okay, but my intentions were good. I did this for you. Even before you were born, I did it for you. Oh, come on, you did it for yourself. I did it for myself, yes, and for my son, for the son I hoped I was going to have someday, to make things a little easier for him, for you. It didn't work out so great, did it? I think it did. I think your life has been easier than it would have been. I certainly hope so. It's been easier than mine was, that's for sure. Dad, look where we are. So? He said nothing. Lori offered in a honeyed voice, Jacob, we need to be careful how we talk to each other, okay? Try to understand your father's position even if you disagree with it. Put yourself in his shoes. Mom, you're the one who said it. I have the murder gene. I did not say that, Jacob. You implied it. Of course you did. Jacob, you know I didn't say that. I don't even think there is such a thing. I was talking about other trials I read about. Mom, it's okay. It's just a fact.
If you weren't concerned about it, you wouldn't have Googled it.
A fact? How do you know it's a fact all of a sudden?
Mom, let me ask you something. Why do people only want to talk about inheriting good things? When an athlete has a kid who's good at sports, nobody has any problem saying the kid inherited his talent. When a musician has a musical kid, when a professor has a smart kid, whatever, what's the difference?
I don't know, Jacob. It's just different.
Jonathan, who had not spoken in so long I had almost forgotten he was present, said calmly,
"The difference is, it's not a crime to be athletic or musical or smart. We need to be very careful about locking people up for what they are rather than what they do. There is a very long, ugly history of that sort of thing."
"So what do I do if this is what I am?"
"Me. Jacob, what are you saying exactly?"
"What if I have this thing inside me and I can't help it?"
"There's nothing inside you."
He shook his head. There was a very long silence, 10 seconds or so, that seemed to last much longer.
"Jacob," I said, "the murder gene is just a phrase. It's a metaphor. You understand that, right?"
Shrug. "I don't know."
"Jake, you've just got it wrong, okay? Even if a murderer had a child who was also a murderer, you wouldn't need genetics to explain that."
"How do you know?"
"Oh, I've thought about it, Jacob. Believe me, I've thought about it. But it just can't be. I think of it this way. If Yo-Yo Ma had a son, the kid wouldn't be born knowing how to play the cello. He'd have to learn to play the cello just like everyone else. The most you can inherit is talent, potential. What you do with it, what you become, all that is up to you."
"Did you inherit your father's talent?"
"No."
"How do you know?"
"Look at me. Look at my life. Like Jonathan said, you know me. You've lived with me 14 years now. Have I ever been violent, ever?"
He shrugged again, unimpressed.
"Maybe you just never learned to play your cello. Doesn't mean you don't have the talent."
"Jacob, what do you want me to say? It's impossible to prove a thing like that."
"I know. That's my problem, too. How do I know what's in me?"
"Nothing is in you."
"I'll tell you what, Dad. I think you know exactly how I'm feeling right now. I know exactly why you didn't tell anyone about this for so long. It wasn't because of what they might think you were."
Jacob leaned back and folded his hands on his belly, closing off the subject. He had clasped onto the idea of a murder gene, and after that I don't think he ever let it go. I let the subject drop too. No sense preaching to him about the boundlessness of human potential. He had his generation's instinctive preference for scientific explanations over the old verities. He knew what happens when science comes up against magical thinking.
Chapter 11. Running.